Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
When it comes to big news stories, it's snooker that's at the top of the sights at the moment, because Ronnie O'Sullivan is out of the World Snooker Championship in the first round. Snooker's biggest name will play no further part in the World Snooker Championship. That's because he's been beaten. He was 5-4 down overnight to James Cahill, the amateur from Blackpool, taking a break from professional snooker, but is now working his way back onto the tour, and no better way to do it than with a victory over O'Sullivan. Quite probably the greatest player of all time. Recently went past 1,000 centuries, and yet James Cahill, 23-year-old amateur from Blackpool, has pulled off a fairy tale victory. O'Sullivan, in fairness, did not look himself really at any point. Yesterday he looked extremely tired. He was rubbing his face a lot, yawning. Clearly, there appears to be something not quite right with Ronnie O'Sullivan. It was interesting to hear him speaking after the match, talking about the lethargy and almost as though he had the flu. Now, I looked at it and thought, we know Ronnie's got a pretty serious history with mental health. And I looked at it and thought, that looks like someone who's going through a bit of an episode, someone who's not quite coping perfectly. Of course, the problem with being a sportsman who has mental health problems is you can't choose when your matches are. You can't say, oh, actually, mate, I'm not feeling great this week. Can we play in a couple of weeks' time? So Ronnie, I think, ideally, would have deferred the match. It's not something you can do. He turned up, he played all right by anyone else's standards, but terribly by his own standards, and was beaten 10-8 by James Cahill. 23, he's from Blackpool. His career prize winnings, by the way, are just £80,000 in his career. I suspect that may be about to go up rather a lot. Much as this is just the first round, in some ways that makes it a little harder. He said that they're so close together because they've got two tables running at the same time. He almost sat in Ronnie's lap at one point, backing up to have a look at an angle, have a look at a shot. But that makes it even harder. Everyone's so close to you. You're on top of you. And you know the enormity of what's going on. You know everyone is there to watch Ronnie O'Sullivan, and you're the one there to upset him. Cahill has a little bit of snooker in his family, by the way. His mother's sister used to be married to Stephen Hendry. Apparently, he has not helped him in his career whatsoever. But he was a guy who was touted to really have some impact in the snooker world. He won the European Under-21 Snooker Championship back in 2013. He played on the professional tour for a little bit, but then lost his card. He has re-won his card for the 2019-2020 season. I think he will come in with a little bit of a bullseye on his back now, because that is a remarkable victory over O'Sullivan. It's not the first time, by the way, that he's beaten some of the top players. Back in 2014, he knocked Ding Junhui out of the UK Championship. He did the same thing to Mark Selby last year at the UK Champs. So he's clearly someone who has the ability to produce some results, but he's never been past the third round of a ranking tournament. It would be quite remarkable if this were the year he managed it at the Worlds. There was a moment which really summed it up and said to me, I think this lad might go on and win it. When at 8-all, Ronnie O'Sullivan had a pink off the spot to win the frame. It was a shot I think he would make 999 times out of 1,000, this being the one time he didn't make it. He hit the jaw of the pocket. It was never really close, to be perfectly honest. He left Cahill a very tricky little pink. He actually played safe and won the safety battle, slotted the pink, but had to play the black right off the cushion. A difficult shot. He took his time over it, and he rolled it in, didn't even touch the jaws, absolutely inch perfect. Gave him a 9-8 lead, and the rest, as they say, is history. Sunk a pink to seal the final frame, smashed his hand on the table, pumped a fist and shook a hand. If James Cahill tops that moment in his career, he will have done very well indeed. But for the moment, I hope he has a couple of shandies to enjoy it.
Love Sport.
They might be wondering if they could have got a little bit more. They did play well. Chelsea were having an off night. That much was clear, at least in the second half. And of course, they did lead. Brilliant volley from Jeff Hendrick. But two goals in 3 minutes, one from N'Golo Kante and one from Gonzalo Higuain, pegged them back before, of course, Ashley Barnes got the header that proved to be an equaliser. We thought the game had a lot more goals in it, but after 25 minutes, they were done. Burnley fans still pretty jubilant, I think, to have taken a point that confirms they are safe in the Premier League for this season at least. There was one point when you might have thought they'd be pushing further up the table, but they proved not to be the case. Let's see what the sports editor for the Burnley Express, Chris Bowden, thinks. He's on the line now. Chris, a great result for the travelling Burnley fans last night and confirms Premier League safety once again. Do you think there might be a few people thinking we could have done a bit better than this?
What, in terms of Burnley's season? Or...
Yeah, the season as a whole, because I think of Burnley, maybe it's false expectations, but you know they have been up in the top half of the Premier League, and if they finish this year 15th, I don't know if I would consider that where I think Burnley should be finishing.
I think I said sort of at the start of the season, you know, taking into account the Europa League and this, that and the other, and not really doing enough in the transfer window. I mean, survival is success for a club like Burnley in the Premier League. And, you know, it seems sad to say it when you know, it's not the limit of their ambitions, but staying in is a huge deal. And I think anything that involves finishing above 18th, especially this season, has to be success. But I think if you look at those clubs, anyone outside the top six, the big six, and Everton, who've never been relegated from the top division, the rest of them are much of a muchness, and you can literally finish anywhere from 7th to 20th, I think.
Let's just return to the game last night a little bit. Obviously, it was full of controversy towards the end. Was this a classic Burnley getting under the skin of a team who, to quote someone else, don't like it up 'em, sir?
Massively so. It's what Burnley have... based the success under Sean Dyche, having that strong jaw, being able to withstand pressure and being able to be effective when you get the opportunity, be that in open play or dead balls. And you fancied them from set pieces last night. I think, Louise is susceptible. It proved so when Burnley won on the opening day of the season last year. And I think they only had really, two or three opportunities to force pressure from set plays and scored from two of them. But you look at I don't think Tom Heaton made a decent stop from Aspilicueta second half, but you'd expect him to make that. And other than that, it wasn't really a vast number of glaring opportunities for Chelsea.
Do you think it is overly simplistic? I wonder if it's a Southern gaze thing for us to go, oh yeah, Burnley, they kick you, they play defensive and try and nick it on the counter and set pieces. Are they a better side than that?
Well, I think they are. I mean, they're capable of playing when they get the opportunity. If you look at anyone watched Burnley win at Bournemouth, I think Bournemouth almost allowed Burnley to play at times, and they probably out-muscled Bournemouth on the day as well. But, they were convincing winners there. But, they've gone to Old Trafford, took a two-goal lead for the second successive season and ended up with a draw there. They've beaten Tottenham at home. They've beaten the Premier League champions in every season they've played in the Premier League, and they play... The last opportunity to do that this season is on Saturday against Manchester City. But I was sort of having this debate last night that you look at how Chelsea won the Champions League in 2012, and they did the same against Barcelona. Camped in their 18-yard box. Messi misses a penalty, but they managed to find a way through. And Bayern Munich, I think the shot count was something like 35-9 in the final. Chelsea had one corner to Bayern's 20, and Chelsea scored from the corner. With Drogba in the last seconds to get into extra time and win on penalties. And
it's not illegal to play defensive football. This is what I don't get.
No.
It's not illegal at all. That's Chris Bowden, sports editor of the Burnley Express, one of the great papers of the Northwest, the Burnley Express.
Love sport.
It's all the biggest stories in sport, one of which you might have missed, actually, which is West Ham applying for their game to be moved on the 4th of May. They're taking on Southampton at the London Stadium, and they want the game to be moved because their women's team have made it through to the FA Cup final at Wembley. They're taking on Manchester City at 5:30. West Ham are playing at 3 o'clock, and anyone who's ever tried to get from East London to Wembley, or actually get to Wembley from anywhere, knows that it wouldn't be feasible to get between the two games. They want to essentially offer their ticket holders for the Southampton game the chance to go to the women's FA Cup final afterwards. The Premier League, we understand, have refused the request. Now, that is disappointing. I was initially led to believe it was on the final day of the season, when all the games have to be at the same time. That is, in fact, a week earlier than that. So we are on Saturday the 4th of May, West Ham taking on Southampton. So there are TV games that day already, Bournemouth are playing Spurs at 12:30. Cardiff are playing Crystal Palace later at 5:30. Newcastle-Liverpool's the late game. So the Premier League could have moved that game if they'd had the foresight to do so. As it is, they refused, which means that I think that FA Cup final will probably miss out on a good few thousand fans who might have been able to go to West Ham Southampton in the early game, have a beer, head up to Wembley and watch the Wembley. I mean, it would be a great day, wouldn't it? I would do it. Go and watch two games of top-level football in the same day on the same ticket. Brilliant idea. But unfortunately, being kiboshed by the Premier League, we're unaware as yet why. And they might change their mind, it does happen, but realistically I think they will be sticking by what they've originally said. It's extremely disappointing because this is a massive summer for women's sport. England will head to the Women's World Cup with a very realistic chance of winning it. They'll certainly be favourites to make it as far as the semi-finals, and after that, who knows? We've also got the Netball World Cup coming up as well. And women's sport is starting to take a real place in the British sporting calendar. You know, Barclays are going to sponsor the Women's Super League now. A massive deal for them. Much bigger TV deal than they've ever had in terms of money. It's all lining up to make sure that women's sport gets something like an even footing. I know it's nowhere near that at the moment. And maybe it never will be because the gender imbalance is what it is. But we're starting to get there. However, it massively needs the support of the governing bodies. And it needs the positive discrimination. You wouldn't do it if, say, West Ham under-18s were playing in the FA Youth Cup final late on the Saturday. But when is the FA Youth Cup final? Ben, you're a Chelsea fan. It's always on like a Thursday night, isn't it? Or a Friday night. It's never on at a time when the team is actually playing so that fans can go. So the FA and the Premier League will make things work so that fans can go to both the under-18 games and the Saturday games of the senior team. They put the Youth Cup as a two-legged affair during the week so that fans can go. But they won't do it with the Women's FA Cup. That is, to me, absolutely mad. Now, you might say, well, the FA should have scheduled it on a day when there were no Premier League fixtures. When are those days? Honestly, there's one day in the last 10, I think, that doesn't have any Premier League or Championship football on it. So how are you supposed to find a date? Never mind the fact that you don't know which two teams are going to get through to the final. How are you supposed to find a date when it doesn't clash with Premier League action? I don't know. Surely, you could ring up the Premier League and say, look, lads, do you think we could... And I say lads because they are lads. Part of the problem, by the way. Do you think we could maybe find a date when we can get the FA Cup Women's Final on and, you know, make it work so that we can get lots of fans in? Because let's face it, the FA Women's Cup is becoming a big deal and they want to get a big crowd in. And maybe the Premier League go, oh, yeah, well, we'll just wait until we see who's in the final and then we can rejig the fixtures so that, you know, you don't have too much of a clash. I can't guarantee it won't clash with any games, but, you know, who's going to watch Cardiff Crystal Palace anyway, frankly? I know that's a cynical view, but they could have done it and they didn't. And that, to me, is really disappointing. I know it's not in the Premier League's requirement. They work for the clubs. They work for the men's clubs, realistically, don't they? But nevertheless, you could think they could have a bit of sympathy for people who are just trying to promote a sport. I don't know. Maybe I'm old-fashioned. I'm also old-fashioned because I watch games all the way through. I don't just watch the highlights on Twitter. I think that makes me an old man. But it also means that occasionally I pick up a few little things you might have missed. Things you might have missed from the Chelsea game last night. N'Golo Kante's goal was mostly down to a terrific bit of skill from Eden Hazard. But in the build-up you might have missed, Ruben Loftus-Cheek's rampaging run through the midfield. I mean rampaging almost in a literal sense, because he picked up the ball, strode into the Burnley half, and that attracted the attention of the ever-keen Ashley Westwood, who made his way over and went to go shoulder-to-shoulder with Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who's a big lad, I think we can all agree. And then in a scene that was reminiscent of George North, who got the ball and then picked up Izzy Folau with him on the rugby pitch during a Lions tour a few years ago, Loftus-Cheek basically shielded the ball with his body, and Ashley Westwood bounced, and I mean bounced, like he'd just run into a very large trampoline, ended up flat on the ground. The goal was a bonus, but I thought the physical humiliation was the bit that was really enjoyable for me. Gonzalo Higuain got a goal last night as well. Smashed it in off the crossbar to give Chelsea a lead. He wheeled away to the corner in celebration. So much relief and excitement. He probably got a little bit more than he bargained for when he got to the corner flag, I reckon. Skipped past it, celebrated with the crowd, and he was grabbed by a woman in the crowd for a celebratory hug. He ended up with a face full of cleavage, frankly, and she held him there for a few seconds and then he jogged off. He had to go and play another hour of football after all of that. Seems like a bit much, really. I'd have wanted a cigarette. And spotted in the crowd last night, something else you might have missed, Alistair Campbell, former Labour spin doctor. He's famously a big Burnley fan, but I think that even Tony Blair's old spin doctor might have struggled to pull the positives out of Chelsea's performance last night if he were deployed on the blue side. That said, I'd have quite liked to see Tony Blair do Chelsea's post-match interviews, actually. Given that Maurizio Sarri refused to do it, that would have been very watchable. And frankly, by the way, Blair would have done a better job, as I say. The Italian was so angry that he refused to do his post-match media commitments. Gianfranco Zola was put up as a peace offering, and he claimed that Sarri had been offended by something said by the opposition bench. What a snowflake, eh?
Love Sport.
They say a week is a long time in football. If you're a Chelsea fan, an hour is a long time at the moment, partly because you have to watch them, but also because things can change so quickly. In the space of 75 minutes last night, the Blues had gone from leading 2-1 at home, celebrating a powerful finish by their number 9, Gonzalo Higuain, and heading 2 points clear of third place. They went from that, jubilant I'm sure they were, to Callum Hudson-Odoi and N'Golo Kante going off injured, Ashley Barnes heading an equaliser, their manager sent off in furious mood, and then at the end, their resting centre-half, Antonio Rudiger, scrapping with the opposition bench. I mean, it was poor. It was a poor way to end as well. If Arsenal and Manchester United win their games in hand now, Chelsea will find themselves heading to Old Trafford on Sunday with sixth place beckoning. Now, that is not where they want to end up. I'm sure it's not unexpected, and let's face it, they're in the Europa League this year, but such is the life of a football manager. Maurizio Sarri is learning the hard way how fickle the Premier League can be. To a certain extent, this does feel a little self-inflicted, because much as the fans got on his back very quickly and turned from his unbeaten run, I think he's now asking for trouble because he's sort of saying, I'm struggling to motivate the players. I'm struggling to do half-time team talks. That is not the kind of thing that a manager who's necessarily going to hang around a long time and motivate a squad says, I would have thought. Let's ask a man who knows Chelsea inside out and far better than me, Pat Nevins, on the line. Pat, where did it all go wrong for Chelsea last night? I thought they started with some quite nice flowing football and then it all seemed to go to pieces.
I'm not sure any pieces, really. They just they didn't move the ball quickly enough. You always hear Sarri saying the same thing when it doesn't work. He always says, well, Sarri ball works, but you need to move the ball quickly. And when the odd time Burnley actually came out of their half, or even indeed their penalty area, there were one or two chances to break. And when they broke, they didn't really quite break quick enough. And by the time they got to the Burnley 18-yard line, there was this mob of Burnley players all standing inside the 18-yard line. And they just weren't cute enough to break that down. And that's part of the deal. That's no complaint from me about Burnley, may I add. That's one way to play, and if it works and it gets you the point that keeps you in the Premier League, I'm not complaining about them. But for Chelsea, it was nearly 80% of the possession, a whole bunch of shots, most of them blocked because there was that whole big bunch of Burnley players there. So where did it go wrong? Well, not being extraordinarily cute enough to get through that mass rank of defenders.
Do you think this changing the way, the speed at which they play the ball, yes, you do have to play the ball quickly in order to make it work. Is that something that footballers at this level should be able to adapt to? Or is it a question of finding people who are more used to playing with that fast-flowing passing style?
That is a brilliant question. And I think it might get right to the heart of where the problems are for Chelsea. Because you watched Manchester City trying to do that in the initial stages when Pep Guardiola came in, and it took a while for it to work that way. And when it did start working, we were all purring. But before that, we were saying, oh, lump the ball. Well, I wasn't, but lots of people were saying, get the ball out of the back. It does take a lot of work. And you have to look at the players who are quite capable of doing it. I have to think there was one other problem, which I don't know how many people have mentioned about last night. N'Golo Kante going off at halftime made a massive difference. He does one thing that's very specifically quite interesting for that style, which is he wins the ball but wins it incredibly high up the pitch. because he's playing in a different position now. And that makes a difference because you've not got 90 yards to run between winning the ball. That transition works higher up the pitch. So Kante getting the ball up there, it suddenly looks a lot better. When he's not doing that, then Chelsea really don't seem to have any quick breaking. And it does look a bit predictable after a while.
What do you make of the Kante positional move? I was, quite impressed with him last night. And actually, I'm starting to wonder if Sarri might be a genius in moving him into that position. Do you think it is a better use of his skills to play him that little bit further forward?
Well, see, you and the rest of the country, what kept you? That's what I'm saying. Because I've been saying it from, about 5 or 6 games in. I'm thinking, oh my God, he's got it right. I love what he does. Kante up there is adding much more. Now, that doesn't mean to say, he can't play that central defensive role. And if you played a 4-2-3-1, I would definitely play him there, allowing one of those two sitting midfielders to break. But him playing up in that area, winning the ball high and causing all sorts of problems to defences, I think is absolutely brilliant. Now, he's not going to score a whole bunch of goals, even though he scored one last night. He's creating the odd goal here and there. But it's how he changes the dynamic of a game when he's that further up the field. So, yeah, I'm happy you think that. I have to say thank you for saying that because I thought I was in a minority of one for the past 4 or 5 months.
So I thought you were going mad, Pat. I assure you're not. We're all just catching up with you. You're well ahead of us.
To be honest, on top of that, I write a column for the Chelsea website and I've been writing this for months and months on it. And even the Chelsea fans are saying, oh, you're talking rubbish, Nevin. But I do think there is something in that. I think he's pretty special in that position.
Yeah, well, hopefully he remains in that one because, whatever happens to Maurizio Sarri, maybe this is one discovery that will remain, is that N'Golo Kante can actually play that little bit further forward. Now, the drop points last night feel like a missed opportunity with everything else that's going on around Chelsea. If you had to put your hand on your heart and say Champions League or Europa League next season, by league qualification that is, which do you think it will be? Will they get back into that top four or remain in that top four, I should say?
Again, start of the season right till now, Chelsea's my team. But I've never thought they'd get top four not at any point. That's not because they're awful. It just takes a long time to adapt and change what was a massively different change of system, style of play, etc. I don't think all the players are sort of right there for that team. I think Chelsea are exactly where they should be just now for the quality of players that they've got. The bigger problem is, if they don't get in there and they don't manage to get in the Champions League through Europa League, because that's as good a chance, obviously, as any, they've got a real problem for next season if they can't buy in some players. I'm sure Sarri, if he's still there, and I don't know the answer to that, if he's still there, he'll want to get some other players that are more suited, can move that ball much, much more quickly in that kind of midfield area. And whether he's going to be able to do that when they've got a transfer ban, that's a real difficulty. The problem Chelsea have got at the moment, I think, is they would kind of like to stick with him. Because I think they would like to build in that. The pressure is on. They've never kind of stuck with managers before. But in the past, they've always had more money. They just throw bunches of money at it and fix it. I don't know if they can do that now. Certainly not in comparison to the likes of Manchester City, etc., who are spending as much, if not a lot more, than Chelsea at the moment. So they're in a tricky situation. A lot of Chelsea fans don't like the idea of keeping Sarri. I understand that. I will not be devastated if he's still there this next season. I'd quite like to see what he brings and pushes on further next season, with the big caveat of, oh dear, what the hell happens if our star man goes to Real Madrid?
Don't even speak it, Pat, for heaven's sake. This weekend, just finally, because I know your time is short, Pat, Manchester United, do you see Chelsea upsetting them at Old Trafford?
I've got a great chance of doing that. Chelsea haven't been particularly good away from home this season, particularly against the big teams. It's, they have looked, a bit off the pace. But watching some of the games recently, I've got a bit of hope. I was at the Liverpool game when Chelsea played at Anfield, and they were basically just out-muscled, out-run and out-fought. I'm not sure Manchester United are the kind of team to necessarily do that. So we know that period that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had at the start was brilliant, but I was at the at Paris for the PSG game, and I remember thinking, right, he's going to get the job now, and they should have been battered that night. So many chances against them. I mean, it was a magical night, but they should have been hammered. So it was one of those ones where I think, you know, they're beginning to weaken a little bit now. So it's two teams that are either capable of winning that game. It should be an absolute cracker. Big problem, this is, you're chatting before the City versus Manchester United game. If Manchester United don't beat City and they're up against Chelsea, Chelsea can basically destroy their season there and then. They're out of the league. They're not getting in the top of the four. The top four. So, I mean, that's a big, big push for Chelsea. It looks like they might have another half chance, but I still think the big favourites are... Well, I don't know about big favourites, but I still think the favourites for those two places are Spurs and Arsenal, but it's not by much.
Pat, thank you so much for joining us here on Upfront with me, James Gray. An absolute pleasure as always. That's Pat Nevin, former Chelsea player.
Love sports.
Miraculous victory over Ronnie O'Sullivan. He clearly wasn't at his best, the world number one, the five-time world champion. But nevertheless, Cahill got the job done. He won 10-8 this morning, having led 5-4 overnight. Really, one of the biggest shocks the Crucible might ever have remembered. We'll speak in just a moment to Sean O'Sullivan, another professional snooker player, about exactly what that means for James Cahill, what it might do for his career. But frankly, he's back on the professional tour next season, and he's going to go around with a little bit of bullseye on his back, I reckon, because that is an absolutely remarkable victory he pulled off under real pressure. A couple of shots, a pink in the 17th frame in particular, when Ronnie had missed it off the spot. He was left with a very tricky little rest shot, and he found a way. He engaged in the safety battle. He won the safety battle, actually, and then he found a way to get the pink and black. It was quite remarkable from James Cahill. Let's speak now to Sean O'Sullivan, a fellow professional snooker player, a man who was also, until recently, playing in the World Snooker Championships. Unfortunately, he didn't make it through as far as Cahill. But Sean, what a remarkable result for James Cahill. You must be delighted to see such a big result, a fellow professional pulling off a massive shock like that.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see. I mean, I've known James from the junior days. We're similar ages, so it's good to see an up-and-coming player from England coming through. The grassroots of snooker really hasn't been great in the last few years, and there hasn't been much talent pushing through the ranks. So it's great to see him coming on a run like this and beating Ronnie at the biggest stage that there is. And like I was saying about the grassroots, I think there's something that world snooker need to look at. I think they need to get some more coaches involved. And that's why I've got involved with it as well. I'm starting doing some coaching, and it's something that they need to look at. But for him to come through on this magical run, it's brilliant to see.
You mentioned that, you guys are similar age. I think you're a little bit older than him, but not much. Tell me about him in the juniors. I know, for example, he won a European Under-21 title. He did turn pro relatively young. And what do you make of him as a player? Did you always look at him and think, if you can put it all together, you will be a very dangerous snooker player?
Yeah, he was always a player you liked watching. I think he's got brilliant cue action. Very good on the eye, and he's a lovely bloke as well. So it's just great to see. You looked at him and you thought he could definitely make it in the game, but it's just like you said, just putting all the things together, and it looks like he's starting to do that. Mm. I know he's been working with Chris Henry, who's also my coach actually, so I know exactly what he's been working on, and I know what he's going through, so it's great to see that it's working for him now.
You mentioned Chris. I was going to ask you about him. What makes Chris, I mean, clearly, and James actually mentioned it in his post-match, that the work with Chris, that he's joined up with, has been pretty crucial. What is particularly different about Chris Henry? Are there any tricks of the trade that you can reveal?
A lot of the stuff is all upstairs. It's how you deal with pressure situations, and just being comfortable and being able to relish the pressure, which you could see from today. That clearance to win 10-8 was as much pressure as you'll get, really, against someone like Ronnie at the Crucible. So, you can see that he's definitely been working on that. And, technically, I think he's very good, so that was never really an issue. So, it's just for most players, it's all about how you deal with the pressure.
We mentioned that James obviously turned pro, then went off the pro tour. He's qualified for a new 2-year card now. How tough is it at that level to try and stay on the professional tour and to try and make ends meet in some ways? I mean, you guys obviously have been operating at similar levels for a few years. It must be quite hard graft.
Yeah, it's not easy, especially for myself. I mean, I've been a bit of a yo-yo, really, journey for me. I've been on and off the tour the last sort of 5-6 years. I've been on and off 3 times, so I know I'm good enough to be a pro, but to break through and get into the top 64 is just such a big step, and you really do need to get on a run, really, of some wins to do that. And I think, especially for James now, the momentum he's got going into next season, I think he could do that. He could be very dangerous, and it'd be great to see if him push on, really.
Do you think he can go much further? I think he's got Stephen Maguire in the next
round.
Yeah,
he's got Stephen. I don't know. I mean, why not? I think he's certainly playing well enough. And Stephen, to be fair, should have lost to Tian Pengfei. So, I don't know. I think they'll both just be delighted to be through, and it'd just be great to see a good game. And then whoever wins, you know, I think obviously Stephen is the more likely to push on in the tournament. But I can't see why James can't beat him.
Mm. Just a word on Ronnie. It's a story with two sides in every sport. There's a winner and a loser. He didn't really look at the races, did he? He looked like there's something going on. You know, you mentioned how important your coach's work, Chris Henry, is upstairs.
Yeah.
I wonder if Ronnie was all there this time around.
Well, yeah, he didn't. I mean, he looked unwell, to be honest. I mean, he's been tweeting a lot about his nutritionist and, you know, eating well and all that. But I'd be wanting my money back if I was looking like that after, you know, after a couple of days of snooker, to be honest. I mean, he's had a couple of weeks off. He didn't have to go to China. So he should be, you know, the most well-prepared of everyone, but he did not look up for it at all. And I don't know whether that was just because he's not feeling well or whether the pressure was just a bit too much for him. Because he was under a lot of pressure because of, you know, no one expected James really to win, and all the pressure was on Ronnie, as always. So
When he goes 5-4 down overnight, it must start preying on you. Sean, thank you
so
much.
He would have been stewing.
Sean, I've got to ask you, because I know you're an Arsenal fan, and it's all going a little bit pear-shaped. Have you got any confidence you'll be in the Champions League next year?
Well, I've been looking at the fixtures. I think it was a couple of weeks ago, I looked at the fixtures and I thought, you know what, we've actually got a great chance. But we've got 3 of the last 4 games are away from home. So
they're rubbish away from home, Sean. They're absolutely awful away from home.
To be honest.
Yeah, rubbish.
I think our best way of getting in the Champions League now is through winning the Europa League.
Yeah, yeah. And that's going to require some bottle, and that's something Arsenal famously haven't got. I'm sorry to slag off your team now that you've come on the radio with me, Sean, but frankly, Arsenal they feel like they couldn't win a one-man show at the moment. Thanks so much for coming on, though, Sean. It's a real pleasure to have your expert insight, someone who knows James Cahill as well, off that brilliant victory. That's Sean O'Sullivan, a professional snooker player and a guy who knows James Cahill just as well as anyone else. Cahill, of course, not Ronnie O'Sullivan, out of the World Snooker Championships earlier today. That is probably the biggest shock the Crucible has ever seen. Can he go further? As Sean says, why not?
Love Sport.
Our job is always to pull out any positives that we can. Maybe some vulnerabilities, maybe the amount of games that they're playing. Because, of course, the odds are stacked against us. So you have to look for any small margins or details where possibly you can get some sort of success.
Brighton manager Chris Hughton there. Of course, they take on Tottenham tonight. It was once upon a time, I think, going to be the first game in the Tottenham Stadium, but it got moved. Now they will just take them on. They'll just be another team visiting the new Tottenham Stadium. Frankly, Brighton need the points. They need a result tonight because they are wrapped in an absolute relegation dogfight. They are 3 points clear of Cardiff at the moment, but the way Neil Warnock's side are playing, finding results out of nowhere where, frankly, no one expected them to get them, you'd have to say Brighton needs to start picking up points where we don't expect them to get them either. I just wonder whether they've got it within them. Sounds like Chris Hughton is a man who knows his side are in real, real trouble. They haven't got an easy run in either. After Tottenham, they've played Newcastle, Arsenal and Man City. I think they need to get a point tonight, at least, in order to give them a chance to stay in the Premier League. Cardiff, this is their game in hand, essentially. So after this, they might not expect to get any more points this season. They can set the target tonight. A win is unlikely, I admit. You know, for all Tottenham's misgivings and shortcomings and injuries, they are still a better side than Brighton. But even so, you just wonder whether Houghton can put them together, try and keep it tight for an hour, hour and 10 minutes, and nick a goal at the end. It's the only way, I think. The problem really comes down to losing that game to Cardiff. I don't think anyone saw that. That stemmed from the 5-0 defeat at home to Bournemouth with a man sent off as well. Houghton said they sat down and just watched tape of that game over and over in an effort to try and not repeat it, which makes sense. When you come out of a game like that, though, it does leave scars. It must. You saw when they conceded, they were basically lying on their backs thinking, what have we done? This is absolutely horrific. But on the other side, Tottenham know they need a win as well. The roller coaster of last week might have left them a little bit drained, but they can't afford to let up because they've got Champions League football to try and claim for next season. Let's speak to former Spurs man John Gorman, who's on the line now. John, it can't be easy on your heart being a Tottenham fan at the moment, can it?
Yeah, it's funny you're saying that. I've got some problems anyway, but never mind.
Well, maybe don't watch Tottenham too much then, John. Take it easy, mate. Yeah. It's not good for the ticker.
Yeah, that's good. Don't worry about that. I feel more tonight for my great friend at Brighton, Chrissy Houghton. I'm just hoping that they don't, you know, they get the results that they need. Not tonight, but the results that they need for him to stay up. Ex-Tottenham player as well, and we've managed and coached together at Spurs, you know.
What do you make of Chris as a coach then? Because he's, you know, people talk about him like he does a lot with very little. What sort of is his coaching style, and how does he get so much out of that Brighton team?
He's just the most dedicated person you could meet, really, in football. He's football through and through, and he was, like I said, he was under me, Glenn, at Spurs, and then he took my assistant manager job when I left, and we've been friends even when I was there as a player, because he was my reserve, believe it or not. He's just an unbelievable professional. He just first in every day. He would just, you know, make sure everything's done properly, right, you know, all the crossing the I's and the T's. He's just and it didn't surprise me how well he's done in management whatsoever.
Of course, it's a massive challenge for him heading to Tottenham. We all know about that new stadium, how magnificent it is. Do you think Tottenham will slip up, or do you think it'll be pretty routine tonight?
I don't think it'll be easy, because Brighton are needing, you know, and they want to get that another point at least. Or two, obviously, 3 points would be so. But I still think Tottenham's obviously got a wee bit too much for them. You know, they'll give it their best shot, but. As I said, I just hope that Chrissy gets the points he needs pretty quickly, but I still want Spurs to win tonight, because they need to stay in that top four, and third position is where they want to be right to the end of the season, and you know, they need to win nearly every game really to do that.
We talk a lot about, you know, Mauricio Pochettino's exhausting style, relatively small squad, lots of injuries. Do you think at this stage in the season that could start to catch up with them, you know, with the Champions League semi-final and the rest of it? Or actually, would you rather just play every, you know, play twice a week and the adrenaline gets you through the last few weeks?
Yeah, I think as a player, they definitely would. And there's other players, obviously, they've had their injuries recently, but there's players come stepping up to the mark now, and you know, and it's great, really, to show that it's not all about just the one player all the time, like Harry. You know, obviously, everybody thinks, you know, he's going to be a big miss, which he is. But other players, Muro now and Son in particular, have stepped up to the mark, haven't they, and really showed what their capabilities are. Yeah.
Do you think then that we won't be saying goodbye to Harry Kane anytime soon, that he's in Tottenham for the long haul, because there's been a lot of talk about, you know, other clubs being interested in him, as you'd expect for a goal scorer like
him? Yeah, you're always going to get that with Harry, because he keeps being the top goal scorer, and, you know, he is one of the best players in his position in the world at this present time. But, you know, hopefully Spurs, especially with the new stadium, can hang on to him. But if not, football, there's always another one. There's always somebody else in football. That never worried me as a coach or manager. There's always another player to step up and take over. Harry was a young player not that long ago, and people wouldn't have expected him to have done as well as he's done. Mm.
John, just finally, I wanted to briefly ask you, of course, we heard the sad news this morning about Billy McNeil passing away. I know you spent a bit of time with him at Celtic. I wonder if you could give us a flavour of the man as a player and as a bloke.
Oh, he's that's why I said to your associate, I said, please ask me about Big Billy. He was my hero. He was my hero before I was a Celtic fanatic. And I was, even when I was 14 years old, he came to Uphill Saints, my team, and sat beside me. I was in total awe of him. He was giving me the Player of the Year award, and for some reason, I got the coach put me beside him, which was, and then within about a year, I was at Celtic Park myself, and I was training with him every day, and obviously he became a great friend, and you know, he was just loved, and he was just, I mean, I was at Lisbon, I was there when Big Billy picked up that European Cup, never ever to be forgotten, and every Celtic fan just absolutely adores him because he is Celtic, and I'm very, very passionate about Big Billy, and his wife Liz was an absolute wonderful lady as well, and all his family, I think he's got four girls and a boy. We used to kid him on about it, and I think until he got the boy, but he was just loved by all the players and the supporters as well. He is Caesar, he's the king, and he is the best person that could ever have been associated with Celtic.
John, thank you so much for that tribute to Billy McNeil, who passed away at the age of 79 yesterday. That's John Gorman, former Tottenham defender, and of course spent time with his childhood hero, Billy McNeil, at Celtic. He passed away at the age of 79, but he was, remember, the first British man to lift the European Cup that famous night in Lisbon. Celtic's greatest ever season, the Lisbon Lions, they call him, Billy McNeil, 79.
Love Sport.
I did want to talk a little bit about boxing, though, because you will have seen today Eddie Hearn talking about the potential replacements for Jarrell Miller. Now, Anthony Joshua is still going to fight on June the 1st, but he's not going to fight Jarrell Miller because Big Baby failed a big old doping test. Multiple doping tests, actually. So the scramble is on to find someone willing to get in the ring with one of the most dangerous men in the world at 6 weeks' notice. 6 weeks' notice in boxing, by the way, is not stupid. But for a massive world title fight, it's effectively nothing. For context, Joshua's ideal training camp is about 14 or 15 weeks, plus a couple of weeks of pre-camp to do cardio before that. Those preparing to face him will probably want to do something similar, maybe a little shorter. So whoever takes this fight is never going to be one of the contenders. You know, one of that gaggle of fighters who believe they actually have a legitimate chance of fighting and beating Anthony Joshua. This is going to be a bolt from the blue. A no-hoper. Probably. It's going to be someone who will look at Carlos Takam, the man who was already in camp but had less than 2 weeks' notice to fight AJ in Cardiff when he lasted 10 rounds and propelled himself into the top 10 heavyweights in the world. It earned him several paydays on top of the multi-million pound clash with Joshua. Now, a lot of people look at this opportunity and think that's what can happen. I'm not going to beat Joshua, but I might be able to last a few rounds and it'll prove that I can at least go toe-to-toe at world level and add some value. People think they can beat me, but I'll also get into the ring with some decent fighters. So we're not going to get a classic in New York, I'm afraid. But actually, let's not pretend it was ever going to be. Eddie Hearn and co. cannot possibly stand there and say that a drugs cheat has robbed the public of a fight for the ages. Actually, all this drugs cheat has done is change the name on one side of the billboard. So he's keeping the blokes putting the billboards in work anyway. This fight was always designed to be the one before the one. At very best, it might be the one before the one before the one before the one. Joshua remains a name in America that people have heard, but not one that people really know. If Hearn wants an ironclad negotiating position in a bout with Fury or more likely Wilder, the evidence of having sold a big pay-per-view show to an American audience is an excellent weapon. This was always going to be a glorified exhibition, and it will continue to be so, no matter who replaces Jarrell Miller. Eddie's shortlist, by the way, and I don't believe some of it, is thin at best. He mentioned Luis Ortiz. That's a carrot at best. It's never going to get eaten, by the way. There's no way Joshua would agree to fight Luis Ortiz at 6 weeks' notice. He's a southpaw, he's dangerous, he hurt Wilder. You need a full camp preparing for someone like him. You don't want to switch opponents to him halfway through. Not to mention the fact that Ortiz wouldn't take the fight anyway. We understand that he's not interested in fighting Joshua at 6 weeks' notice. It's an exactly the example of what I was talking about. Ajit Kabayel, Hearn's mentioned, he's European champion, carries no reputation in the States, and he's hardly a world-level fighter. Manuel Char, similarly a nobody. I've literally never heard of Trevor Bryan. Michael Hunter is a cruiserweight. He's only got two fights in the top division, although he did take Alexander Usyk 12 rounds at previous weight class. And Andy Ruiz Jr., who I'm starting to worry might be the actual bloke they get in. He looks like the kind of guy who tells you you're not getting into walkabout at 1 a.m. on bank holiday Monday. Honestly. He's not that intimidating a bouncer. It's kind of embarrassing that Hearn's going to stand up in a press conference this week and talk about how Joshua's going to get a sterner test from whomever he eventually does a deal with. It'll be nothing more than a light spar without helmets, and Joshua will do as asked and punch somebody's lights out. Instead, Hearn should actually be realistic about what this is. You can't have a cup final every week. If you did, they wouldn't be exciting. Sometimes you've got to go to Dynamo Kiev and get a gritty 1-0 win. There has to be light and shade. Otherwise, the light is not bright by comparison. And by the way, that's what this is. This is a gritty 1-0 win in Dynamo Kiev, whoever Joshua gets in the ring with from that list. It's not really a competitive fight. Joshua will knock him out. His team will crow it was one of the best heavyweight performances on the road by a British heavyweight. And then we'll move on. But that's what really frustrates me, is that boxing's become such a ravenous hype machine, constantly needing feeding, that every bout has to be a showdown. You know, every fight has to have beef, and each and every contest must be settling some sort of past score, whether it be, you know, a clash in sparring or the fact that he once kissed his girlfriend when they were 9. Honestly, it's pathetic. If we weren't obsessed with the unbeaten, and if every fighter didn't have some sort of Poundland belt to defend, it wouldn't be like that. There wouldn't be 1,000 unbeaten fighters in every division. You'd get good quality, competitive fights on every card. These days, you're lucky if you even get 2 competitive fights on a 10-bout TV card. It's beyond a joke. Joshua, for me, because I think AJ is a fighting man, and I genuinely think he's the sort of guy who wants to get into the most competitive fights. So this is my message to you, Anthony Joshua, because I know you're a big listener. You need to stop being driven around in a Bentley by your promoters and told what to do, and occasionally wheeled out the back door to knock out a pub fighter. You need to turn around to them and say, I'm ready. Bring me the biggest fighters. Then we'll all watch. Again, again, and again. It'll make you, by the way, even more money. Because if you fight Tyson Fury 3 times, I'll pay for every single one. If you fight Deontay Wilder 3 times, I'll pay for every single one. And that way, you've at very least got 120 quid of my money.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.